Welcome to Beauty at Work. We are in between seasons at the moment, so please enjoy this clip from one of our episodes.
When I studied mathematics, I had a boyfriend who also studied mathematics, but he had a second major, I think you would call it, which was sociology. So I became very interested in sociology, in particular in the question like, what can mathematics tell us about sociology? So I've always had this side interest in, you know, the dynamics of groups and what can go wrong in groups. Also partly, I think, because I'm German and, you know, some things went wrong in Germany. So what happened was after my PhD, as I said, I worked on the possibility that the Large Hadron Collider could produce those tiny black holes. And the first time I gave a talk at an international conference about this, so not an internal thing, someone asked me, why would those black holes be produced at the Large Hadron Collider? Why not at even higher energies? Like, why should they become accessible right now? And the answer I gave to this was what I'd read in all the papers. It's an idea called naturalness. It's because that's natural. And yes, you could push it to higher energies, but then it would no longer be natural. And this person, you know, I still see him sitting there, nodded and was like, yes, okay. And I felt incredibly dumb because I didn't understand the answer. You know, it was just right. Something that I'd read somewhere. And so after this conference, I tried to make up for this and tried to figure out, like, just exactly how does this argument with the naturalness go. And now it's very interesting if you look in the literature, like, it goes back to an idea that came up in the early 90s or something around the time. People were very clear that this is an ambiguous concept. You know, it relies on some arbitrary assumptions about the probability distribution, but it doesn't really matter. The thing is that it's like it's a human construct, so to speak, and it fulfills certain purposes that, which is why people invented it at the time, but it was never meant to be a criterion to single out particular theories as good and others as bad. This is something which developed much later, which indeed, interestingly enough, by Gian Giudice, who was, when I wrote the book, he was the head of the theory division at CERN, but I think he isn't anymore. In any case, so he's like a big, you know, big guy in the theoretical physics community. He wrote a paper, which you can read on the archive, where he says that this idea of naturalness developed by a social trend or something in the community. Social trend is not exactly the phrase that he used, but it was something very similar. You know, I'm not good with pulling quotes out of my memory, too old for this. Sure. So in my head, this kind of, it rang this huge warning bell. It was like, this is like really weird. Like, this is not an argument that you would expect to appear in science. And so when I looked into this notion of naturalness further, it turned out to basically be a beauty ideal. You know, it's like we want our theories to be this way, but there is no further reason for it. There are a lot of scientists, theoretical physicists, who have tried to come up with justifications for this idea, but they all fall apart if you look at them any closer. There have actually been some philosophers who've written about this. And so I ended up in this weird position that, I had based my PhD thesis on something which, in hindsight, I don't think made any sense. So I and
do you mean naturalness? Was naturalness per se part of what you're saying there?
Okay. So this is the interesting thing. It didn't actually come up in great detail in my thesis. It's just, it enters in this assumption that it becomes accessible at the energies that the Large Hadron Collider could produce. So it underlies all those predictions for new physics at the Large Hadron Collider. They're all based on this idea of naturalness.
Maybe I should ask you to specify then before. Sorry. What, to just for our listeners who don't know what naturalness means, could you sort of give a brief definition of that?
Well, naturalness is the idea that if you write down a theory and you have to introduce some numbers without units, then those numbers should be approximately one, not exactly one, but somewhere close to one. And then we can discuss exactly how large or small can they be. You know, is three too large? Is seven too large? Some people, you know, would maybe accept even 10 or 100, but you wouldn't accept something like 10 to the 15. And the standard model happens to contain a number. Actually, there's a second number, but let's stick with one number that's best known, which is the mass of the Higgs boson divided by the Planck mass. That gives you a dimensionless number, which is about 10 to the minus 15. And physicists say that's too small. It's not natural. They think it requires an explanation. And this gives you justification to add all kinds of new physics, for example, supersymmetry, or for example, extra dimensions, which lead to those tiny black holes. And there are lots of other things that you can add. They're all based on this idea that you somehow need to get rid of this small number. Now, there's nothing, technically wrong with this number. It's just a number. You know, you put it into the theory and it works. And that's, in fact, how people use the standard model. They just put in this number, done. So it's not like there's mathematically, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that they don't like it. and I didn't quite like this justification. And so what happened was, after my PhD thesis, I couldn't find a justification for what I had done myself. And no one seemed to understand what my problem was in the first place. People basically told me, I just don't understand, you know, undergrad physics. Look at those lecture notes, this kind of stuff. And so I was like, okay, I don't understand what those people say, but I want nothing to do with it either. So I decided I'd stop working on it. And that's what I did. Actually turned down a pretty big grant. And all my friends said I'm crazy for turning it down. So I went to Perimeter and I worked at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Canada. And I worked on how to experimentally test quantum gravity for several years, because I thought that was, it doesn't rely on this idea of naturalness. But this was all before the LHC turned on. And at this point, I was pretty convinced that all those arguments for new physics at the Large Hadron Collider were wrong, because they were all based on this idea of naturalness. And so I started writing about it, first on my blog, started writing about this before the LHC turned on, I want to emphasize.
Right.
Well, you know how it went. You know, those new particles were never found. After a few years of this, physicists began moving their predictions to higher energies, because that's the way the story has been going for several decades. I just, you know, it was just obvious that at some point they'd say, we need a bigger collider.
Right.
This is when I thought, I have to write a book so people understand that this argument isn't scientific. Discuss how well the broad public would actually understand what's fairly philosophical, technical argument in my book. But still, I felt like I have to do it, because who else would do it? Like, I was basically the only one. And this is why I wrote my book. I just felt I had the responsibility to explain to people why, if they put all this money in a next bigger collider, it almost certainly wouldn't find something. And this almost is very important, because, of course, I can't rule it out. You know, it could always be, they find something after all.
Right. Yeah, so it's a sort of canary in a coal mine situation, right? It seems like you were sort of raising the warning bells and pointing to the red flags as the LHC is taking off. And so there's naturalness that's one of the criteria that's being used in making these predictions. There's also, you say, simplicity and elegance. Are they also driving these predictions? Could you say a bit about those?
Yeah, maybe one thing I should add is that the people who work on this stuff, they don't think of it as beauty. You know, it's just, for the most part, they just use it as a mathematical requirement. And you have to prod them a little bit, you know, to figure out just why do you use it, basically.
Because it's not necessary for mathematical consistency to assume these things.
Exactly.
Right?
That's exactly the point. It's not necessary. And yeah, so besides this naturalness, they use simplicity, usually in form of unification. This is very prominently present in the idea of unification of the forces in the standard model, where physicists have developed new ideas starting in the 1980s, and they have been falsified to the extent that they could be falsified. There are still some, you know, out there, which people are trying to falsify. And whenever one gets falsified, you can come up with a new one. So basically, it's not going anywhere. And then this idea of elegance is kind of, it's a fairly vague idea, but that people have quoted to me many times. It's basically this idea that a theory has to give rise to surprising connections. You know, you have to get something out of simple assumptions. For example, string theory is a theory which is often described as very elegant because it starts from this very simple idea. Everything is made of strings, tiny interacting strings, and they wiggle around and so on. But then you get out surprisingly many things, like, for example, the graviton, right? And you can also get fermions and bosons and gauge groups and stuff like this. So it's really amazing.
Yeah, yeah. But just because one set of theoretical assumptions can generate these outcomes, that doesn't mean there aren't other ones out there that may not look so beautiful, right? I mean, is that part of your argument there, that this doesn't have to be the only criteria by which we make predictions about theories or that should drive theory choice?
Yes, it's a little bit more complicated. A lot of people think that I'm a string theory critic, which is actually not the case. You know, as I said, I've always been very sympathetic to the idea of string theory because it solves a real problem, which is the problem of how to unify the standard model with gravity. So for which you need the theory of quantum gravity. At least this is the idea. You know, technically, it's never been shown that it actually solves the problem. So this is where the problem starts. I think string theorists have basically given up even trying. They generally believe that it does, but I think formally it's never been proved. So that's already weird. But at least in principle, I think string theory has a good motivation in the sense of solving an actual problem. So I don't have a huge problem with string theory, but where problems start is stuff like supersymmetry, which, string theory kind of needs supersymmetry, but let's leave this aside for a moment. Supersymmetry is believed to be necessary to solve this naturalness problem, but I'd say it's not necessary to solve the problem to begin with. So what do you need supersymmetry for? supersymmetry is not just one model. You know, it's a huge number of different types of models. It's really complicated, which is why there have been so many papers written about it, because there's so much stuff that you can explore in this great mathematical space. But as you correctly say, just because you can write it down and it looks pretty doesn't mean it actually describes reality. And there are lots of theories that you can write down that look good on paper, but they just don't describe the universe that we live in.
Yeah, yeah. So is this massive sort of generation of papers around beautiful mathematics some kind of mathematical masturbation? Or like, what do you see as driving this kind of pursuit, right? I mean, I think one of the things you point out is just the abundance of papers that are being written, and even the abundance of journals. And I read some recent statistic that 70% of the publications these days in scientific journals are not read by anybody. And I wonder how this sort of the social context of science is driving some of what you're seeing here.
I think it's a generational thing. So I think that the people who originally started working on this, as I said, you know, after the standard model was completed, they had, you know, pretty good motivations, and it made sense, you know, that the next thing that you'd look at would be a grand unification or string theory, so you could include the graviton. But then over the course of time, This didn't work out. And people just started making those models more and more complicated. And it's around this time that things started going wrong. You know, then there were experiments coming in and they falsified some of those theories, but they didn't get the message. You know, they just continued doing the same thing over and over again. And then at some point, I think people learned that you can get away with it. You know, you can do it. You can publish those papers, even though there's no evidence for it. And even if they are falsified, you just move on to the next thing and that pays the rent. So it becomes this big bubble of nothing. And I think that they're not really aware of that this is what's going on, because if you've grown up in this community, and I mean, they're all serious scientists, you know, it's not like they're frauds or something. They all believe it. And it's really hard to go and say, well, actually, this doesn't make any sense. You know, why are you doing this? If you have like several thousand people telling you that, but of course, that's the thing to do. And this isn't something which is specific to particle physics. I find it interesting that a very similar thing has happened in psychology and parts of sociology, where they had this issue with the, you know, sloppy measures of statistical significance, which is something that mathematicians and statisticians have been writing and warning about for decades. So it wasn't that it was difficult to realize. But they did it because everyone did it. It's what they, you know, that's what they were taught to do. And they thought it was okay. So, and as I said, it becomes really difficult. If you are in this community, this is how you make your income. And it's okay because you can get it published, then you continue doing it. So so that's the interesting question, is then how do you stop something like this? And the psychologists managed to do it, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and they are still struggling with the reproducibility, replicability crisis and with p-hacking and so on. We still don't have enough respect for null findings. And so we're constantly chasing after whatever you can, you know, demonstrate as being statistically significant, which is easy to manipulate. So, these are really powerful biases that you point out, right? I mean, groupthink and social desirability and the sunk cost fallacy and then this big blind spot that scientists of all people, would see themselves as being immune to these biases. So what was the reaction to your book? I mean, how did scientists respond to it? Were there people willing to say, "Gosh, I realized that this bias was driving me," or did they sort of reject your argument, or what's it been like?
There was basically no reaction from people in the community, at least not that I've heard. It's not that anyone came to me and said, "Oh, you know, your book really made me think." It just didn't happen. But I mean, you know, I've been very vocal about it, and I've made fun of particle physicists deliberately, I have to admit. It's interesting if you look at interviews that particle physicists give on both sides. They don't talk about beauty anymore. This used to be really, really common, you know, in public outreach, in popular science books, on all those pages. They would go on about how beautiful it is, and, you know, unification, string theory, and so on and so forth. They don't do this anymore. So I think I reached some people. They seem to have realized that this isn't something that scientists should openly admit. whether they actually stop doing it, that's another question entirely.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.